Well, I suppose that brings us back to the last caller just before the top of the hour. And a good reminder, too, that over 1,000 people have taken our Insta poll, the story that we put up on the web page at coasttocoastam.com on after the rapture pet care. Is it for real? It seems like a joke to us. The people who are running this service for supposedly for Christians by hooking up a local atheist or a non-believer, a non-Christian, and hooking them up with your pet to make sure your pet's taken care of after you've been raptured. The owner wouldn't come on the air. The people said, no, we're not going to talk about it. We have a suspicion that this might still be a gag, but you go take a look, judge for yourself, and take the poll. Right now it's running 2-1 in favor of this is a gag, but maybe the owners will come on sometime and explain how it's not, if it isn't, and this definitely isn't. The story of Chasing Shadows, Fred Burton, who's a counterterrorism specialist, will explain a significant event you've never heard of coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Ponet. We've had Fred Burton on a couple of times. He's the author of a really fun and interesting book called Ghost: Confessions of a Counterterrorism Agent. And now he's got a new book out, which doesn't actually hit the shelves until sometime later on this week. Is that right, Fred?
Yes, on Tuesday, Ian.
Okay. Well, thanks for coming on early. I know that's not a publicist's dream. They always want to be on when people can order the book right away, but you can pre-order it. You can put the order in at Amazon. You should get this book when it comes out on Tuesday. And in fact, we'll tell you a little bit more about the story of Chasing Shadows in just a moment. But how you been? Good?
I've been fine, thank you. And just so you know, the book is out in Israel. It's a Hebrew version. From what I understand, it has done quite well. It was released in Israel this week.
Well, there's a reason for that, and we'll get into more of that on the way, but it drops on Tuesday everywhere else. I know that you have a very interesting history as a counterterrorism agent. Let's just explain a little bit about that before we get into the bulk of the story you're going to tell us tonight, because in the beginning, it's hard to imagine now that there was a time when our government really didn't quite understand counterterrorism and didn't understand the necessity for it, but certainly you did. Describe a little bit the humble beginnings of the counterterrorism unit with which you served and that you led.
I was a police officer in Montgomery County, Maryland, which is a suburb of Washington, D.C., and I decided that it would be better to go federal for a little better pay.
A bump in pay, yeah.
Yes, and applied to a little-known service within the State Department called the Diplomatic Security Service. They had greatly ramped up their agents after the horrific bombings in Beirut in 83 and 84 of the U.S. embassies. And the State Department Diplomatic Security Service is responsible for the protection of all U.S. embassies and consulates abroad, as well as the resident foreign officials, the diplomats inside the United States. And they also do passport and visa fraud investigations, as well as counterterrorism investigations. And I was one of the first classes of the new agents hired in the aftermath of Beirut, and literally became one of the first three agents that was assigned to the counterterrorism mission for the State Department.
Now, I don't mean to say this like it's comical, like it's laugh out loud funny, but it does seem in hindsight so bizarre to imagine that at one point our nation's premier counterterrorism unit started with three people and almost zero funding and what, like a Commodore 64 computer or something. I mean, you didn't have much to work with back then.
No, we didn't. And remember, this was a time that was before cell phones, before the internet, and we actually got pagers, the old version pagers,
yeah.
After about a year or so. But
after a year, you got a pager. You worked your way up to a pager.
Yes, yeah. We had Our original founder of our group was a great guy, my mentor, by the name of Steve Gleason, who was a former Hartford Police Department bomb squad guy, and he had literally done a lot of these investigations around the globe in the late 70s and early 80s by himself.
Right. Well, I wanted to mention that not just because Ghost is a really good book and it really helps to explain kind of the blueprint for today's modern counterterrorism approaches, but also then even after you left the government, you go into a private corporation and you continue to be part of something which some people refer to as the shadow CIA. Can you explain that?
Yes, we're a private intelligence company with a tremendous amount of following around the globe. Most of the Fortune 100 companies read our analysis and material. We have a website-based service that your listeners can log on to and read our material. A lot of that material on there is free, and we do have a fee-based service, but for the most part, there's tremendous value in just looking at some of our analysis, and we strive to be very, very balanced, and that's tough to find today in the media.
And that website is still run out of that same Commodore 64.
No, it's a little bit different. Our website is doing fabulously well.
Yeah. Well, it's very interesting material. So let me just say, you know I know Ghost, read that a long time ago. I love this book, and it's kind of chilling. And I'll give you the playbook as I see it tonight, is we won't get to the whole story of chasing shadows, and we'll only get so far into this, but to even go as far as we're going to go would take up all of the rest of the time that we have. The material is so rich and it's so fascinating. And then what I'd like to ask is that at some point in the future, when I finish reading the book and I'm about three quarters of the way through, I'd love to have you back when the book is out and just for a first hour follow up on Coast to Coast. You good with that?
Oh, that's fine. Thank you. You're very kind to do that.
No, I really mean it. So and I want to do something a little bit out of order in how you did it in the book. So bear with me on that. I think that there are so many places to go, and I kind of see the story that you tell in Chasing Shadows to be kind of an interesting lens into where we are today. But before we get into that story, let's talk a little bit about the Vietnam War, because eventually when we kind of pull the story back a little bit, you'll see how this plays into it. But I think it's important for people to understand something that you talk about in the book, and that is that there was a time when, as hard as it is for Americans to perhaps believe it now, the United States Air Force was struggling against the North Vietnamese Air Force during the Vietnam War. And in fact, if we look at the numbers on this, the U.S. Air Force was losing to the North Vietnamese Air Force. Can you explain that?
Yes, and it was because of the very sophisticated aircraft that the North Vietnamese were flying that we did not have that technology, which again, in our post 9/11 world in Afghanistan and Iraq and Libya today, it's hard to imagine that at one point in time America did not control the skies like we do now. But in essence, you're absolutely correct. The Soviet technology that had been provided to the North Vietnamese was state-of-the-art and in many ways far superior to what we had.
Okay, now I'm going to push you on that a little bit, too, because I think you make such an excellent point. We're talking with Fred Burton. Again, the book is Chasing Shadows, and we'll talk about the murder investigation that is central to the story in a moment. But back in the 60s and early 70s, while the U.S. Air Force struggled against the North Vietnamese, the United States Navy jets, you know, the Top Gun guys, the U.S. Navy fighter jets, they were having greater success when they were engaged in dogfights with the MiG jets of the North Vietnamese. Can you explain to everybody the difference between why the U.S. Air Force was struggling and why the Navy was succeeding? Because that's important to know when we get to the story coming up.
It's centered on, Ian, that remember that if you go back and look at the difference, there was no commonality between the two different services, in essence, between the Air Force and the Navy, and that the there were several studies that had been conducted going back to the Korean War, and it looked like, though, that the Pentagon's Defense Department's weapon system evaluation program, that commonly called the Red Baron reports, that they were looking at all these air-to-air engagements to date, and looking at all the after-action reports, they concluded that the Navy was substantially outperforming the Air Force. And it took a while to figure out why, but it appeared that the Navy had simply been not fighting almost realistic-like battles, and it's kind of hard to explain.
Wait. That the Air Force hadn't been fighting. They had stopped training their fighters to dogfight. They were, because of the, if I remember quickly, you said because the jets were expensive, the technology was still nascent. They were reluctant to have, in fact, it even had some sort of rule that said the Air Force fighter pilots couldn't engage in high-risk dogfighting drills while the Navy did. And so when the Navy actually then engaged the North Vietnamese, they were ready. But our Air Force was, our pilots, unfortunately, were kind of caught in the middle where they weren't trained well enough to be able to fight these MiG jets.
That's correct. And in essence, from 1953 to 64, the U.S. Air Force engaged in no active air combat missions whatsoever.
And even in the simulations, I mean, you hate to think about the human lives that were wasted, because it would seem that these pilots were poorly trained. And that they lost the people of the brass in the Air Force lost the big picture, and they were looking at the budgets, they were looking at the zeros and the ones, they were looking at all the expenses of these planes and the technology that in some cases meant that they were losing a plane a day, an expensive jet a day, due to high-risk training. And they said, that's it, no more high-risk training, when in fact high-risk training is what they needed to do in order to be ready for these dogfights over North Vietnam.
That's right. And the Air Force, the U.S. Air Force, also suffered an exceptionally high loss rate during normal peacetime flying operations during this time period.
Okay, so I wanted you to point that out early, because we'll get back to that, and that's important to know as sort of a backdrop to what happens later on, because this murder that takes place in 1973, and that's why all of our bumpers tonight come from mostly from the summer of 1973, this murder that takes place intersects your life long before you became a police officer and then somebody with the DSS. Talk about that night and talk about that family and the town in which you grew up.
The Alon family, which is the victims in this case, Colonel Joe Alon, was a Israeli military attaché and former fighter ace for the Israeli Air Force. In essence, he was one of the original founders of the Israeli Air Force. And a lot of diplomats in the Washington, D.C. area, he lived in this little subdivision of Bethesda, Maryland, which is, you could throw a rock to the District of Columbia line in that time period. And this was my neighborhood. My father owned a gas station in the same neighborhood. I had actually went to school with one of Colonel Alon's daughters at Bethesda Chevy Chase High School in Bethesda, Maryland. So it was just a quiet little town. And in 73, of course, I was in high school, and the last thing you have any, at least I did, any knowledge of was global international events or the Arab-Israeli struggles, as well as it's hard to fathom that you had gasoline at 20, 25 cents a gallon.
Yeah, that's the hardest of all of it, I think, is remembering when gas was a quarter a gallon. Yeah. But, okay, so there you were, this working in your dad's Chevron station and going to school with a girl whose father was in the United States working for the Israeli government. That wasn't a secret. That was not a terrible surprise. So talk about the night of the murder.
The Alon family, specifically Colonel Joe Alon and his wife, had been to a diplomatic reception of another Israeli diplomat that was transitioning back to Israel in Chevy Chase, Maryland, which is adjacent to Bethesda. And he had a little bit too much to drink that night. Again, this was a different time period in America. Of course, he was a diplomat and a fighter jock. And he drove a very short distance back from the party. As the crow flies, it's about a mile and a half, pulled into the driveway of his house. And these streets are extraordinarily small streets that look very much today what they did in 1973. And the homes are mostly one story, typical suburb. The garage door was open, so he pulls into the driveway. He's got another older car in the actual garage that he had been working on. His wife opens the car door, walks out, and proceeds up towards the steps of the front porch. Joe, I've since come to call him that over the
sure.
years. Joe reaches back to grab his jacket, and at that point in time, the wife hears a gunshot and looks around and doesn't really know at that moment exactly what to do, but yells at the daughters to call the police. She actually tries to dial it herself, but this was before 911 again and didn't really know what number to call.
How about that?
Then decides to run outside, and at the same time, she hears a succession of four additional shots. And she thinks for a moment and says, well, if there's a gunman still out there, the front porch light is on, and so she unscrews that. And then rushes outside, and Joe is on the front lawn at the house, literally bleeding. He had been shot five times, and she yells for the daughters to bring some pillows and some blankets out that I have pictures of in the book. They attempt to render whatever first aid they could at the time.
So on the front lawn of his own home, without anybody seeing a shooter, the wife doesn't see a shooter, the kids don't see a shooter. He is hit by several bullets, although most of them wouldn't have been fatal. There was one shot that would have gone, through his armpit and then into his heart and then through his heart and out through his chest cavity.
That's correct. The way the trajectory was, as Joe was reaching behind him to get his jacket in the rear seat, that twist of the body caused the round to kind of angle through and to clip his aorta.
So that's either an amazingly, if you'll pardon the term, lucky shot by some would-be robber or just some random shooter, or that's a really professional marksman who knew how to get a body shot even when somebody's reaching for a jacket out of their back seat and to make it count. And the multiple firings lets you know they were determined to make sure they didn't leave that night without this Israeli colonel being dead. So now we have the murder. It took place back in June of 1973 in Fred Burton's hometown. We'll talk a little bit more about the investigation and then how it stalls and then how Fred gets back involved with it again in later, about 3 or 4 or 5 years ago now, and what that can tell us about what's going on in international politics today. Coming up on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. Very likely you won't have a memory of a famous international incident that never was. The murder of a colonel, an Israeli colonel. This is the Israeli government. This is a military that had an entire wing dedicated to vengeance, of getting revenge, you know, of settling scores, of making sure that if somebody like a one of their diplomats had been shot, somebody like this colonel that was serving in Washington on behest of the Israeli government, if he had been shot, why didn't they ever seek justice for him? And why did the FBI investigation stall? Well, Fred Burton knows why, and it's the story of Chasing Shadows. We'll get back to that next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. So Fred Burton was telling us the story of this colonel, Joe Alon, who was assassinated in his front yard, virtually in front of his entire family as he died in their arms. What would have been, a highly unlikely kill shot by most people, but he was taken down by several bullets fired at him. Fred Burton was a teenager back then. He didn't solve the crime back in 1973, because suddenly this would turn into like a Hardy Boys mystery if he did, right? He would have been. But you come back into the story later on, and I want to pick up the narrative of that in a moment. But I want to go back to that thought I said, because you make a point to talk about the Israeli government and how it would have treated ordinarily any of its people if they had been killed or kidnapped around the world. Talk about the reputation that the Israeli military had for vengeance.
Well, in essence, this goes back to after the Munich massacre of the Olympic athletes killed, when the Wrath of God squad was put together to target the terrorists, specifically Black September, that were responsible for those assassinations and literally eliminate them wherever they may be. So at a backdrop of what's taking place here in 1973 is this shadow war between the terrorists targeting Israeli targets and the Israeli Mossad predominantly looking for the terrorists and part of a preemptive program to eliminate the terrorists before they struck. And I can speak firsthand to that, too, in a different sidebar. If you go back to the hostages that were kidnapped in Lebanon during the 1980s, and I did the bulk of those debriefings, the Israelis, through intelligence channels, would always ask questions about one of their missing servicemen that had also been kidnapped. So the Israelis had a very, very firmly held belief that they should not only go after the people that were responsible for killing them, but also take every step they could to leave no stone unturned to locate their persons that were missing.
And so even in 1973, the Israeli military had, the government had a reputation for protecting its own and for making sure that if you were out on the, you know, if you were out on the branch of service for your country, you weren't going to be out there alone. And yet, describe the events that happened after this colonel in the Israeli Air Force, Colonel Joe Alon, after he is assassinated in his front yard in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. in 1973. Explain what happens after that.
It was, in retrospect, and looking back through the files, it was a fascinating set of circumstances to go through the thousands of documents that I acquired through the FBI's Freedom of Information Act and the Defense Department and so forth. Literally the next day, President Nixon and Henry Kissinger assigned Air Force Two to fly the body of Colonel Alon and his family back to Israel. And I couldn't find another example at that time, and still can't, of a similar occurrence where we've actually used Air Force Two is traditionally used by the vice president. It's also the backup plane to Air Force One. So that was a big cowbell that went off in my head that, you know, why did this occur? You could see a C-5A or some other discrete military aircraft flying the family back, but no, they used Air Force Two. Then, in essence, Dr. Kissinger had been requiring daily updates on the status of the investigation. I've worked a lot of terrorism investigations, a lot of assassinations, bombings, you name it. I can't recall those kinds of specific requests going up to a cabinet-level official at any point in my career in cases such as that. The FBI, remember, in 1973, was really not equipped to investigate international terrorism. It's an organization that has transformed itself, as we all know, but in this time period, they were simply not equipped to do so. And actually, there was a kind of a humorous story. The original FBI case agent, Stan Ornstein, a wonderful man, came forward to help me with this case out of the blue. He's since retired and so forth. He recalls getting a phone call from the police that night, and he thought it was a joke because this kind of thing never happened. And he was on a small little, what they call a resident agency in Wheaton, Maryland, which is another little town suburb. And he got there about an hour and a half after the actual murder. They didn't have these huge crime scene teams that you see today on TV or what you envision on CSI. In fact, the responding uniformed police officer was literally kind of overwhelmed with this. They kept him working all night, and he was assembled the next morning to brief all these folks in suits. And he said, "I had no idea what really occurred. I was just the first man there."
Yeah.
It was just the way these kinds of cases were investigated during that time period.
Kind of a, I mean, I don't, it won't be too disparaging, but kind of a clunky, kind of sloppy investigation into this murder. And it was not an international incident. As you said, Air Force Two dispatched to take the family immediately back to Israel, which was unusual. The Secretary of State is being briefed on this investigation, which, you know, you could say the Secretary of State is concerned about keeping good relations with Israel. But later on, I think you make a very strong argument for there was a subtext to that, which wasn't yet apparent to people back in 1973. But anyway, you look at it, the investigation just stalls, and the family doesn't get any justice at all. There's nobody that the file becomes open and then eventually just dusty. And then back in Israel, there is no investigation about this either and no action taken.
That's correct. The wife who I'm afraid went to passed away without really knowing what happened, she launched an unbelievable campaign to try to see as many high-level officials as she could back in Israel. Now, remember, Israel is a very small country. I have a few of the pictures in my book, Chasing Shadows, but Colonel Alon Joe knew all the principal players of the country at that time, Rabin, Sharon, Moshe Dayan, and in fact, there's a great photograph of him with Ben Gurion, believed to be the founder of Israel from 48. And so she had direct access to all these people. And the message she got back from all of them was, leave this alone. Get on with your life. And so that also kind of stuck with me, is that was a very odd response, knowing the Israeli mindset as well as their efforts that they launched after Munich. So it took a while to kind of figure that out as well, as to what was occurring there. And then after the mother passed away with cancer, two of the three daughters really did a marvelous job of continuing to not let this case go inside of Israel. In fact, even suing the Israeli Supreme Court for access to information and documents and so forth. So it was just kind of an amazing
way. But they wouldn't give up on that.
Yeah, they're just wonderful women that are just very persistent.
And if they hadn't been persistent, you wouldn't have the material you have. Again, the book is Chasing Shadows. It doesn't drop until Tuesday, but get your copy of it as soon as it comes out. And I think you're already getting an impression on why this is such a hot seller in Israel, as it's already been printed in Hebrew there, and why I think it's going to make a great movie if you're lucky enough to get somebody to get behind it that way. Because the as you said, the family stays with the daughters. The mom stays with it until her death, and then the daughters pick up the mantle in battle and continue to press for why was our dad killed. And we should say, you know, this guy Colonel Joseph Elon, who was shot in the front yard of his own house, was his residence in suburban Washington while he was serving for the Israeli government. He was a war hero. He was not a small deal in Israel. He was a big deal. He was a very well-known fighter pilot in Israel that was involved in some of the biggest defenses and offenses of the short history of Israel.
Absolutely. And in essence, he was specifically handpicked to come back to the United States as the military attaché, which was responsible for liaison with the Pentagon, the Air Force, the CIA. I mean, there was nothing that he couldn't touch in that capacity as the military attaché. And but he also had been a guy who had taken the inferior fighter jets and had defeated the Arab armies in the sky with just your traditional Red Baron dogfighting.
Right. The superior planes, much like the MiGs that they were flying over northern Vietnam that were sort of punishing the United States Air Force at the time.
That's correct. And, of course, he also... in the same time period, there was a very famous Mossad operation of in essence, getting
stealing.
A source, a pilot,
stealing.
Yeah, to bring a MiG-21 to defect with that MiG, that Colonel Elon was involved with this case. And in essence, that MiG-21 ended up at Groom Lake, Nevada.
Area 51.
Correct. And
I want to unpack that a little bit so that people understand what you're saying. So back then, in what year was it that the Israelis were able to convince this Christian Iraqi pilot to give up a MiG-21? What year was that?
It was in June of 1967, and in essence, the Israelis they were very concerned that the Arab, the Soviet MiGs were going to give them air superiority, in essence, to the Arab armies like Egypt predominantly, and that unless they stayed ahead of this technology, they were going to lose. So they launched an extensive effort to covertly try to get a defector out with a MiG, and lo and behold, they did that. And to make a long story short with that, there was a decision made at that point in time that because of that special relationship between Israel and the United States, that MiG would be crated up and shipped over to Groom Lake, Area 51, so our Air Force's Foreign Technology Division could study that. Here you had, remember, as the backdrop in the Cold War, this was the brass ring for the Air Force, because you had a MiG that you could examine and literally look at rivet by rivet.
Well, in both a Cold War and a hot war, so the MiG, getting a captured MiG from Israel, getting one that had been turned over by this Iraqi pilot to the Israeli government for $1 million and a new identity for him and his entire family, right? Wasn't that the deal?
That's correct. That was probably, if you look back in the history of intelligence operations over the past 40, 50 years, that was certainly right up there as maybe one of the top five that any government's been able to pull off.
But that was really crucial. So 7 years before his murder, 7 years before he's assassinated, Colonel Joseph Alon helps coordinate one of the biggest intelligence coups, getting this MiG-21, MiGs that had been, you know, were both hurting the United States Air Force over North Vietnam, and then also were quite a challenge to the Israeli Air Force, although they were holding up better in the dogfights with the Arab governments for the survival of Israel. They were faring pretty well, but it helped them to be able to know what the MiGs could and couldn't do, what their weaknesses were, and that's just what the United States needed to know. So this will all make sense here. Just a minute. We'll pull this all together, both why we were talking about why the U.S. Air Force was doing so badly over North Vietnam, and then the murder of Colonel Joseph Alon. Because when he comes to the U.S., what was the official story of why Colonel Joseph Alon was and his family were in Washington, D.C.? What did everybody think he was doing?
Well, remember, and I've done a lot of work with the Israeli government across all their different intelligence services, and the two principal key posts for the Israeli government to have their best and the brightest is London and Washington. And in essence, if you step back in 68, in the late 60s, early 70s, with the Cold War dominating everything, the U.S. Strategic empire against the Soviet Union, Joe Alon is selected to come over, but that was the overt kind of cover for why he was here. But make no bones about it, the real reason was this was a man who had flown jets that had defeated Soviet equipped and manufactured jets and Soviet mindset of pilots in the air. And so it was crucial that he was here at the belly of the beast to be able to go directly to the Pentagon. I've talked to countless people that said, and even the original FBI agent that night was told by a senior military official that you have no idea how critical this man was to our ongoing operations when it came to air superiority. And, like most agents, especially a street agent at the time, you really don't understand what that means. You know, that's not your mindset. That's not your mission. You just know that this man had to be critically important to whatever the United States government was doing.
Okay. So he had to be critical, and yet there was no investigation of him. There was a stalled investigation in the U.S. He had to be critical to the Israeli government. He was a war hero and somebody who was in an elevated role of representing the entire Israeli government in a very key function with the U.S. in 1973. And yet neither the U.S. nor the Israeli government can pull together an investigation to find his murderer. Why? Well, as you suspect, they didn't want to know, or they already did know. It was the why that would explain it all. And Fred Burton will talk more about that coming up next hour on Coast to Coast. We'll talk about how the family now, in hindsight, knows it was being watched, lines were being tapped, and what else they could tell about what was coming in hindsight. We'll explain it all next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett.